Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Today, in episode 26, I'd like to start out by talking about food fads. One of my pet peeves is supplementation, and this relates to an important principle in trying to understand health and nutrition. And this is scientific reductionism. A reductionistic approach is where you try to narrow things down to a single thing and then pretend or believe that that is what is controlling the situation. This is actually a common side effect of science because part of the scientific process is to try to have only one variable that changes and you measure that. But it often leads to the illusion that that one variable is like the thing, and you make some finding and then try to blow up some half-truth into the full truth. And today I'd like to talk specifically about vitamin D. One of the things with supplements is that the promise of supplements has failed over and over quite consistently over recent decades. And the interesting thing about vitamin D is it's hardly really even a vitamin. It's not really even found in diet unless you're eating like cod liver oil. And one of the oddest things that I think is a side effect from this latest, you know, fad of recent years with hyping up vitamin D is on the new nutrition labels. They added vitamin D as one of the things that they report on the food labels. And now the food labels aren't completely implemented, so you'll find that only some of the food labels have vitamin D listed. That's the newer one. Well, because vitamin D isn't really found in foods, it's always going to be zero. It seems kind of crazy to me, and really the only possible thing to come out of this is that food manufacturers are going to start adding vitamin D just to show that it's not zero. Seems really crazy. Okay, but I'd like to really much nail my prediction that vitamin D is a fad and way overblown with this study reported in Science Daily. High doses of vitamin D may result in a decrease in bone density. When bare skin is exposed to sunlight, it makes vitamin D, which is needed by our bodies to absorb calcium and ensure strong, healthy bones. With bathing suit skin exposure, it only takes about 10 to 15 minutes of sun exposure during the summer to generate all the vitamin D your body needs for the day. And by the way, your body stores vitamin D for a long period of time, so if you do a lot of sunbathing, you know, part of the year, it'll last you throughout the year. Okay, on with the article. Volunteers had their bone density and bone strength measured using a new high-resolution computed tomography, CT scan, of bone at the wrist and ankle, called an extreme CT. You gotta love any report that involves extreme CT. And this is used only for research. The extreme CT, located at the McCaig Institute's new Center for Mobility and Joint Health, is the first of its kind in the world and allows researchers to look at bone microarchitecture in detail never seen before. Standard dual X-ray absorptometry, DXA, bone density was also obtained. Participants received scans at the start of the study and at 6, 12, 24, and 36 months. Bone mineral density, or BMD, is determined by measuring the amount of calcium and other minerals in a defined segment of bone. The lower the bone density, the greater the risk for bone fracture. Adults slowly lose bone mineral density as they age, and the standard bone density scan results showed a modest decrease in bone mineral density over the duration of the study, with no differences detected between the three groups of vitamin D. However, the more sensitive measure of bone mineral density with high-resolution extreme CT showed significant differences in bone loss among the three dose levels. Total BMD decreased over the three-year period by 1.4% in the 400 IU vitamin D group, 2.6% in the 4,000 IU group, and 3.6% in the 10,000 IU supplementation group. The conclusion was that, contrary to what was predicted, vitamin D supplementation at higher doses were not associated with an increase in bone density or bone strength. Instead, the extreme CT detected a dose-related decrease in bone density, with the largest decrease occurring in the 10,000 international units of vitamin D per day group. We were surprised to find that instead of bone gain with higher doses, the group with the highest dose lost bone the fastest. A secondary outcome of the study indicated a potential safety concern with taking high levels of vitamin D. The investigators found that participants assigned to receive higher doses of daily vitamin D supplementation, 4,000 or 10,000 international units, over the 3 years were more likely to develop hypercalciuria, elevated levels of calcium in the urine, compared to those receiving a lower daily dose. Hypercalciuria is not uncommon in the general population, but it is associated with increased risk of kidney stones and may contribute to impaired kidney function. What we can see in this study is that large doses of vitamin D don't come with a benefit to the skeleton. I consider this one probably the beginning of the end, if not the end, of confirmation of my prediction that vitamin D supplementation is super overhyped. And certainly if you're going to do supplementation levels at no more than 100% of the recommended daily allowance. When you get into higher amounts, this has been shown time and time again with all kinds of promising supplements, it actually causes problems rather than solves problems. Okay, well, that's the public health nutrition lesson for today. Let's move on to the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up great public health stuff so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from The Intercept, emails show Monsanto orchestrated GOP effort to intimidate cancer researchers. In 2015, the World Health Organization's cancer research arm, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, or the IARC, classified glyphosate, an active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup, as a probable carcinogen, setting off a global debate about the world's most popular weed killer. Over the last 4 years, Republicans in Congress have excoriated and pushed to defund the IARC, casting their defense of the chemical as a quest on behalf of the small American farmers. But according to a recent trove of documents, the ongoing political assault on the IARC has been scripted in part by Monsanto, the St. Louis-based chemical and seed conglomerate that produces Roundup and Roundup-resistant crops. The newly disclosed files include company emails, documents, and deposition transcripts showing that Monsanto lawyers and lobbyists guided lawmakers, coordinating efforts to question the IARC's credibility and slash U.S. support for the international body. The documents also suggest that the firm has used its influence with lawmakers to antagonize regulators, applying pressure and investigative threats to shape the science used to research glyphosate and other controversial chemical compounds, as part of a larger campaign to silence critics and discredit the IARC. The House Science Committee devoted an entire committee hearing into questioning the IARC, with a focus on its conduct around glyphosate. Surprise, surprise. They subsequently sent more letters to cancer researchers in Norway, demanding they, quote, correct the flaws in IARC. The House Appropriations Committee followed up by cutting $2 million in funding to the IARC, a symbolic move to distance the U.S. from the international body, which relies on a budget of around $40 million from a range of member countries in the UN. One of the most stunning disclosures revealed that a senior EPA staffer, Jess Rowland, had quietly tipped Monsanto off to the fact that the agency had sought to reevaluate the safety of glyphosate, boasting to the company that he could, quote, kill investigations into glyphosate. Shortly before a crucial European Union vote on glyphosate products, the EPA suddenly released a report declaring the safety of the product. The document was later taken down because it had not yet been completed. One Monsanto official relayed to a colleague that Rowland had told him, quote, if I can kill this, I should get a medal, in regards to the glyphosate review. After leaving the EPA, Rowland went to work in the private sector, consulting for chemical companies. Surprise, surprise. Okay, for some more local news, this also from The Intercept, how Ohio's Chamber of Commerce killed an anti-pollution Bill of Rights. Earlier this summer, environmental activists in Ohio were alarmed by the passage of a mysterious state budget amendment that would close a new avenue for residents to sue polluters. The provision invalidated a landmark anti-pollution initiative passed by Toledo voters just a few months before. Now, emails obtained in a public records request reveal that the Ohio Chamber of Commerce secured the cooperation of a key Republican lawmaker in a successful effort to slip the amendment into appropriations bill at the 11th hour. The email depicts the chamber's environmental policy director requesting a last-minute meeting with State Representative Jim Hoops to discuss the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, the newly minted ballot initiative allowing citizens to sue polluters on behalf of Lake Erie. A legislative aide responded quickly, scheduling a same-day meeting, despite the chamber director's admission that his proposal would need to be submitted after the legislature's deadline. The aide produced draft amendment language to share with him 3 weeks later. The chamber's subsequent revisions made their way into the final bill, effectively nullifying the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. Okay, the people of Toledo versus backdoor deals in Columbus. More bad regulation from the New York Times. The EPA to roll back regulations on methane, a potent greenhouse gas. The Trump administration is set to sharply curtail the regulation of methane emissions, a major contributor to climate change, according to an industry official with knowledge of the plan. The Environmental Protection Agency, in a proposed rule, will aim to eliminate federal requirements that oil and gas companies install technology to inspect for and fix methane leaks from wells, pipelines, and storage facilities. The proposed rollback is particularly notable because several major energy companies have, in fact, opposed it, just as other industrial giants have opposed previous administrative initiatives to dismantle climate change and environmental rules. Some of the world's largest auto companies have opposed Mr. Trump's plans to let vehicles pollute more, and a number of electric utilities have opposed the relaxation of restrictions on toxic mercury pollution from coal-powered fire plants. This is extraordinarily harmful, Rachel Kite, the United Nations Special Representative on Sustainable Energy, said of this and other administration efforts to undo climate regulations dating from the Obama administration. Just at a time when the federal government's job should be to help localities and states move faster towards cleaner energy and a cleaner economy, just at that moment when speed and scale is what's at stake, the government is walking off the field. Overall, carbon dioxide is the most significant greenhouse gas, but methane is a close second. It lingers in the atmosphere for a shorter time, but packs a bigger punch while it lasts. By some estimates, methane has 80 times the heat-trapping power of carbon dioxide in the first 20 years in the atmosphere. Methane currently makes up nearly 10% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. A significant portion of that comes from the oil and gas sector. I find this story very striking because you know we've really reached a bad point when the federal government is actually having their environmental protection laws or the repealing of those opposed by the fossil fuel industry. Yikes. Okay, now onto a story about sexism in healthcare. This from ProPublica. In men, it's Parkinson's. In women, it's hysteria. Once it was called hysterical movement disorder or simply hysteria. Later, it was called psychogenic. Now, it's a functional disorder. By any name, it's one of the most puzzling afflictions and problematic diagnoses in medicine. It often has the same symptoms, like uncontrollable shaking and difficulty walking, that characterize brain diseases like Parkinson's. but the condition is caused by stress or trauma and often treated by psychotherapy. And in a disparity that is drawing increased scrutiny, most of those deemed to suffer from it, as high as 80% in some studies, are women. Whether someone has Parkinson's or a functional disorder can be difficult to determine, but the two labels result not only in different treatments, but in a different perception of the patient. A diagnosis of Parkinson's is likely to create sympathy, but a functional diagnosis can stigmatize patients and cast doubt on the legitimacy of their illness. 4 in 10 patients do not get better or are actually worse off after receiving such a diagnosis and find themselves in a therapeutic wasteland, according to a 2017 review of the literature by academic experts. "This is the crisis," said University of Cincinnati neurologist Alberto Espe, the author of the guidelines on diagnosing functional movement disorders. "It shouldn't be stigmatized, but it is. Number one, patients are wondering if it is real. Does my doctor think I'm crazy? Secondly, doctors can approach it in a way that implies this is a waste of their time." A study published last year in a leading neurological journal stoked the growing controversy. Of patients diagnosed with functional symptoms, 68% were women. This finding, the author wrote, suggests that female sex may be an independent risk factor for the development of functional symptoms. The study prompted a furious letter to the journal's editor from Dr. Laura Boylan of New York City, a neurologist. She argued that the study's results might demonstrate instead that symptoms thought to be psychogenic were actually the result of Parkinson's, and that doctors were slow to identify the brain disease in women. "Disparities in healthcare for women are well established," she wrote, adding, "women commonly encounter dismissal in the medical context. Gender inequality is rife in neurology. Female neurologists were last in pay and had the biggest salary gap between men and women in a 2016 survey of salaries by specialty and gender at medical schools. The American Academy of Neurology has had only one female president in 71-year history, even though women now constitute 40% of the professional society's membership. Female neurologists are also disproportionately underrepresented in awards handed out by the Academy, according to a study last year. In 24 of the 28 years studied, the recipients of the Academy's Lifetime Achievement Awards did not include a single woman. The more difficult question is whether the inequality spills over into clinical practice. Boylan received care from both male and female specialists, and her medical records are devoid of outright indications of gender bias. Boylan said female neurologists are trained in a paradigm of thinking generated by men for men, in which the same symptoms are viewed differently in men and women. There you go, people. An example of sexism present all throughout society, and this example in healthcare. Okay, switching gears a little bit, this story from Science Daily. Overeating wastes far more food than we throw away, suggests research. With every unfinished meal since Band-Aid, you've heard it. People are starving in Africa, you know. True, the UN estimates that rich countries throw away nearly as much food as the entire net production of sub-Saharan Africa, about 230 million tons per year. But is it any less a waste to eat the excess food? Excess body weight corresponds to roughly 140 billion tons of food waste globally, reports group lead Professor Mauro Serafani of the University of Teramo. This figure is a snapshot of the current world population's accumulated dietary excesses, not a rate of overconsumption. It is, though, orders of magnitude higher than current annual direct food waste estimated at 1.3 billion tons. To just drive that home, in other words, what they're saying is the excess body fat that people have from eating excess food is representative of 140 billion tons of food waste. And that compares to the annual wasting of about 1.3 billion tons. So in other words, the excess body fat worldwide of people represents about 100 years of food waste. Okay, back to the article. So much so that growing the world's metabolic food waste would be expected to generate the equivalent of 240 billion tons of CO2. This is roughly the amount humankind released burning fossil fuels over the last 7 years combined. As a back-of-a-napkin estimate, the ecological cost of dietary excess, these figures are close to as good as we'll practically get, and they are monstrously high. The glaring corollary Overeating is bad for our planet's health, not just our own. And overconsumption of farmed animal products by Westerners is probably the single biggest contributor. This is a fascinating story because I reported on food waste a lot. And a couple episodes ago, I reported about actually food that's left in the field, which is usually not counted when you're talking about food waste. And that was a lot higher than estimated. Now we're talking about actually food that's eaten, but it's eaten in excess. Obviously, food that's not necessary, but it's eaten. And the fact that this, like, as a metaphor become real is just striking to me. I talk occasionally about the fact that we are literally eating the planet. Well, this is a literal example of that. Okay, in the category of news that probably isn't really news for people that are paying attention, from Gallup polls, Big Pharma sinks to the bottom of U.S. industry rankings. The pharmaceutical industry is now the most poorly regarded industry in Americans' eyes, ranking last in a list of 25 industries that Gallup tests annually. Americans are more than twice as likely to rate the pharmaceutical industry negatively, at 58%, as positively, 27%, giving it a net positive score of minus 31, or you could just say a net negative score of 31. Americans' net ratings for the pharmaceutical industry have never been lower since Gallup first polled industries in 2001. Okay, more on healthcare news. Advocates sound alarm as uninsured rates rise under Trump. This from The Hill. The uninsured rate is rising for the first time since Obamacare passed, two recent studies show, alarming advocates who fear the problem could get worse. Data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released in July show there were 2.1 million more uninsured people between 2016 and 2018. And a study from the Urban Institute this month using Census Bureau data found 700,000 more uninsured people just between 2016 and 2017. The increase is especially noteworthy given the strong economy, signaling the uninsured rate will rise even higher if the economy worsens and people start losing the coverage they get at their jobs. Liberal advocates are blaming Trump administration policies, such as repealing the mandate to have coverage and cutting funding for outreach to help people enroll. The Trump administration cut funding for advertising and other outreach to sign people up for Obamacare coverage by 90% in 2017. The administration released a report this month showing that 1.2 million people who make too much money to qualify for financial assistance under Obamacare dropped individual market coverage between 2017 and 2018. There are also state-level actions that could be driving up the ranks for the uninsured. For example, in Missouri, the Associated Press reported that 90,000 children and 23,000 adults have lost Medicaid coverage in the past year. Advocates blame the state's faulty new system, which forced some enrollees to provide additional documentation proving their eligibility with just 10 days to respond. Okay, more on Obamacare. This from Cleveland.com. Obamacare health insurance exchange prices to drop in Ohio for the first time. Ohioans who purchase insurance on healthcare.gov, the healthcare exchange, will likely save money in 2020, as the state is reporting an average premium decrease of 7.7% compared to last year, according to the Ohio Department of Insurance. It is the first decrease for Ohioans since the health insurance marketplace was unveiled 7 years ago, and it could be more evidence that the controversial Affordable Care Act is working. Healthcare.gov offers plans to people who do not get insurance through work nor qualify for government health care programs such as Medicare and Medicaid, including people who are self-employed. About 206,000 Ohioans obtained plans on the exchange, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Low and middle-income individuals and families on the exchange receive tax credits designed to reduce the cost of their premiums. For instance, a family of four can receive a credit if they earn up to $100,000. From a policy perspective, it was always assumed the marketplace pricing would normalize over time, said Lauren Anthus of the Center for Community Solutions, a Cleveland healthcare think tank. These insurance providers got experience to understand who they were covering. 7 years ago, when people signed up for healthcare, it was the first time many had received comprehensive coverage or any coverage in years, thanks to the tax credits making it affordable. People obtained expensive procedures they had put off when they were uninsured or underinsured, Anthus said. That drove up prices in the exchange. In 2014, Ohio expanded Medicaid, another part of the Affordable Care Act, which reduced the number of people receiving care in emergency rooms. Most ERs have to treat everyone, regardless of ability to pay, and so hospitals charge people on the private insurance market higher rates to make up for the lack of payment they receive from ER visits. Medicaid expansion has helped reduce private insurance rates, too, Anthus said. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to refund customers for overcharges, and Anthus said that refunds have been doled out to customers for years. A number of changes in Washington have whittled away at the Affordable Care Act, such as allowing people to obtain short-term or catastrophic health plans. If more people end up in the ER due to underinsurance, hospitals may again shift costs to the private market. I think it's a good sign the policy is working, Anthus said, of the 7.7% decrease. It's something to pay attention to as we are debating to remove coverage options for people. Okay, next up from the New York Times. Opioid treatment is used vastly more in states that expanded Medicaid. States that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act have seen a much bigger increase in prescriptions for a medication that treats opioid addiction than states that chose not to expand the program, a new study has found. Expanding Medicaid is probably the most important thing states can do to increase treatment rates, said Lisa Clemens Cope, the study's lead author. But even some states that did expand Medicaid look like they are falling short in meeting the treatment needs. The Affordable Care Act gave states the option of covering many more adults through Medicaid, which covers a disproportionate share of people with opioid addiction, starting in 2014. The law also vastly expanded access to addiction treatment by designating it as an essential benefit that must be covered through the Obamacare marketplaces and expanded Medicaid. Expanding the use of these evidence-based FDA-approved treatments is an important first step in improving care for opioid use disorder, he said. But all too often, treatment courses are short and care for opioid addiction is fragmented from all the other healthcare needs that people have. Okay, some progress, but a long ways to go. Okay, I want to end the show with a series of articles I'm going to put under the good news category. This one from Science News. Plant-based fire retardants may offer a less toxic way to tame flames. Flame retardants are going green. Using compounds from plants, researchers are concocting a new generation of flame retardants, which one day could replace the fire-quenching chemicals added by manufacturers to furniture, electronics, and other consumer products. Many traditional synthetic flame retardants have come under fire for being linked to health problems like thyroid disruption and cancer. And flame retardants that leach out of trash and landfills can persist in the environment for a long time. Okay, and the last series of articles I'm going to put under a title of bad news of things around the world that we don't really need to worry about here in the first world, so that's good news. Okay, this from Science Daily. Water treatment cuts parasitic roundworm infections affecting 800 million people. Roundworm infections can be reduced significantly simply by improving the treatment and quality of drinking water in high-risk regions, according to an international team of researchers led by Tufts University. Out of all the interventions we tested, we were extremely surprised that water treatment appeared to be the most effective at reducing roundworm infections. Water treatment is a relatively unexplored strategy for intestinal worm control. At least 800 million people in the world are infected by roundworm, so even a relative reduction of 18% from water treatment interventions could have a major beneficial impact. Our study also suggests that water treatment could complement large-scale deworming medication delivery programs in the global effort to eliminate roundworm infections. With reinfection rates reaching 94% after deworming treatment, for roundworm infection, a combined approach of mass drug administration and environmental controls, water, sanitation, hygiene, could be critical to gaining an upper hand on these epidemic infections, the researchers say. And also from Science Daily, a quarter of the world's population at risk for developing tuberculosis. A new study from Aarhus University, Denmark, has shown that probably 1 in 4 people in the world carry the tuberculosis bacterium in the body. The disease tuberculosis is caused by the bacterium Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which affects more than 10 million people every year and kills up to 2 million, making it the most deadly of the infectious diseases. From AP News, FDA approves TB tuberculosis pill that cures more hard-to-treat patients. U.S. regulators Wednesday approved a new tuberculosis medicine that shortens and improves treatment for the hardest-to-treat cases, a worsening problem in many poor countries. It's the first TB drug from a nonprofit group, the TB Alliance. Formed to come up with better treatments, the group developed Pretamanid with the help from charities and government agencies. The pill was approved by the Food and Drug Administration for use with two other antibiotics. Decades of incomplete or ineffective treatment has resulted in TB strains that have become drug resistant and aren't killed by long standard medicines. In a key study, the three-pill combo cured about 90% of patients with very drug-resistant TB, usually within 6 months. Patients also infected with HIV, a common situation, fared as well as the other study participants. Pretamanid also appears to stop patients from spreading the deadly bacterial infection after just a few days' treatment. Until now, the best option cured only about two-thirds of patients, took 18 to 30 months, and required up to 8 kinds of shots and pills. Many patients die or don't finish treatment, according to the TB Alliance CEO Mel Spiegelman. Worldwide, TB kills about 1.6 million people annually. It spreads through droplets when someone sick with TB sneezes or coughs. TB attacks the lungs and sometimes other organs. The Alliance will work with the World Health Organization to speed adoption of the treatment in those countries. The Alliance is contracting with multiple generic manufacturers to make Pretamanid and keep it affordable. Okay, and from Stat News, for the first time, clinical trials results show Ebola drugs improve survival rates. A historical clinical trial has shown that two therapies made from Ebola antibodies appear to improve survival rates among people who receive them, health officials announced. The announcement marks the first time a clinical trial has successfully shown that an Ebola therapy improves survival in people who have been infected. It means that we do have now what looks like treatments for a disease which not too long ago we really had no therapeutic approach at all, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of NIAID. I think it's the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Disease. We feel that with agents such as these, that we may be able to improve the survival of people with Ebola and might even make people more enthusiastic about coming for care, he said. Because when you have something to offer an individual, it makes it much more likely you might get them in early. And the earlier the better, as in any disease. Okay, well that ends it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's T-O-P-P-U-N.com. And if you'd like to review this show, listen to it again or part of it, or any previous show, feel free to go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.